Thank you, Mr. Stachina. I got a split sermonette I just heard. 7.5 minutes, we'll be done. Well, welcome, brethren, to Sabbath services here in the Elmira area. Certainly a pleasure to see everybody. Good afternoon, I guess it is. I appreciate Mr. Seeker's split sermon. He called it a sermonette, but he had plenty of time for a split sermon. So certainly appreciate that. I thought about Job this week and his patience, which I required. I was forced to hire a new secretary in my building. It's a civil service position. My secretary was not able to pass the civil service test. So although she's an absolutely outstanding secretary, I'm not allowed to keep her. So this antiquated system of choosing a secretary, they have to be in the top 3 scores on the civil service exam for a secretary. So whether you like them or not, you have to choose one of the top 3. So I had an interview actually with Jackson's principal over at Big Flats. So we had 2 people trying to pick the top 3 on a test. It was very, very interesting. I have a decent secretary. I'll say that. It's very hard to replace the one I have. She was very, very good. So I'm trying to be patient. She's very overwhelmed. But just simple tasks that my other secretary I could give to her, and it was done right. This one's just not getting it. I mean, just simple things like proofreading letters. I'm not the best typer. I make mistakes, so I rely on the secretary before I send it home to parents to make sure that it's correct. So I gave it to her. She proofread it, and I made the changes she made, or made the changes that she suggested, made 400 copies to send home to parents, and is my secretary is actually training the new secretary, which is a little bit awkward, read it for me and said, there's all kinds of mistakes in here. You don't want to send this home, do you? So I just kind of shaking my head and said, well, would you make the changes for me and send it out? And she did. So I'm trying to rely on the new person as much as I can, but, you know, I just don't have time to explain everything. So you rely on the person you know is going to do a great job for you. So the teachers are mad. The administrators are mad. It's just a big mess. So we have an interesting job. We have to, you know, make her feel welcome. We have to train her because that's who we have, whether we like it or not. So even though they're very upset that the former secretary is leaving, we have to welcome the new one. So I need some patience. So I appreciate the reminder of Job. Brethren, the title of my split sermon is God, the Great Influencer. It's kind of based on a book that we're reading as administrators in the district. It's called The Influencer, and I'll refer quite a bit to the book as we go through the split sermon. There's an initial story in the book. It's from a university president, and it goes something like this. He said, as he's looking out the window, he said, I wanted the influence, said the former university president. In the end, I wasn't very good at it. That is, having influence over others, or for that matter, being a university president. He said, I often looked out of the window of my office and watched the man that was cutting the lawn. It seemed as though he had much more influence and control over what he was doing than I did. It's kind of interesting. I think that a lot. I often joke with our school custodian that, you know, let's switch jobs for the week. Let's switch jobs for the month. Because the exact same thing, I feel like he has much more control over what happens in the building than I do. He sees a problem, he fixes it. He doesn't have to get the approval of a superintendent. Doesn't have to go to the board. Doesn't have to try to get 3 other elementary principals, which all happen to be women, and we just don't see eye to eye at times, to agree with me before any changes are made. It's a very, very, very slow process. Our custodian goes out, see the floor is dirty, he sweeps it up. It's pretty simple. He's got a lot of control. He can make major changes in the building by the end of his 8-hour shift. I work 8 months, and, you know, sometimes you just don't see anything. It gets to be frustrating at times. It's a very, very, very slow process. It seems as though the influence that I can have over the staff is very, very minimal. I'm currently reading, as I said, this book called The Influencer. It looks something like this. It's a pretty good book. It says, The Power to Change Anything. The Power to Change Anything. On the inside cover of the book, of course, there's always the little marketing thing that they want you to buy the book. So this is a relatively long one. It starts on the front and actually goes to the back cover. But on the inside, it says this about an influencer. It says, an influencer motivates others to change. An influencer motivates others to change. An influencer replaces bad behaviors with powerful new skills. And then finally, an influencer makes things happen. An influencer makes things happen. So the brief marketing ploy on the inside of the cover says something like this. It says, whether you're a CEO, a parent, or merely a person who wants to make a difference, you probably wish you had more influence over people and your own life. But most of us stop trying to make change because we believe it is too difficult, at times impossible. It is easy to quit after experiencing continuous failure. Lori's got me watching a new show on TV called The Biggest Loser. She says it's our motivation. Motivation for what? Well, she's got me signed up for another crazy thing in the spring called the Tough Mudder competition. Kind of the premises of the Tough Mudder, it's a 10 or 11 mile race with 28 military style obstacles scattered throughout the 11 mile course. Sounds like fun, huh? It's end of April, and I'm not worried about the obstacles. I'm really not worried about the running, but the whole course is filled with mud and water at the end of April in the Poconos. The first obstacle is you have to climb up, I don't know, it's a 15 or 20 foot platform and jump into a lake. So I'm worried about the cold. I don't know how you train for cold, sort of rolling around in the snow. And I said, I figure I'll just get through that when the time comes. So the Biggest Loser is motivation for the Tough Mudder. She says that the people on that show can lose the hundreds of pounds and then eventually do marathons and races. We can do it. Seems good. The Biggest Loser, basically the premise of the show, it's a game show, kind of a reality type game show. And the premise is there's teams of people that are extremely obese. And they feel this is their last chance to make a necessary change in their life to become more healthy. So they're kind of pitted against each other to see who can be the biggest loser or the one who can lose the most weight. I wonder why contestants go on the show. Of course, when weigh-in time comes in, they force them to take their shirts off and that type of thing. So you can just see the very, very unhealthy nature of what they look like. So you wonder, why do people expose themselves on national television to do things like that? Why do they want to do that? It doesn't make sense to me. Well, the show employs two intense trainers. And again, they're pitted against each other. They want to have the team with the biggest loser on it. So the contestants, what do they want to do? Why do they join the show when they talk to them? They want to work with these trainers. These trainers are the great influencers that will provide them with the motivation that they need in order to lose the weight that's necessary. The inside cover of the book continues on to say, we develop complicated coping strategies when we should be learning the tools and techniques of the world's most influential people. So rather than changing what needs to be changed, we cope. But this is about to change, says the inside cover. From the best-selling authors who taught the world how to have crucial conversations comes Influencer, a thought-provoking book that combines the remarkable insights of behavioral scientists and business leaders with the astonishing stories of high-powered influencers from all walks of life. You will be taught each and every step of the influence process, including robust strategies for making change inevitable in your personal life, your business, and your life. You'll learn how to identify a handful of high-leverage behaviors that lead to rapid and profound change. You'll be able to apply strategies for changing both thoughts and actions and marshal six sources of influence to make change inevitable. Sounds like a pretty good book. It's going to do it all for us. Who of us in here do not need changes? I know I certainly need to make some changes in my life. It appears if we read this book, it's going to occur almost effortlessly. Right? We will not only be able to make changes in our lives, but we can make changes in the lives of others as well. It goes on, gets better. It continues on to say, influencers takes you on a fascinating journey from San Francisco to Thailand, where you'll see how seemingly insignificant people have made incredible and significant improvements in solving problems that others thought were impossible. You'll learn how savvy folks make change not only achievable and sustainable, but inevitable. You'll discover why some managers have increased productivity repeatedly and significantly, while others have failed miserably. No matter who you are or what you do, You'll never learn a more valuable or important set of principles and skills than you will learn in this book. Once you tap into the power of influence, you can reach out and help others work smarter, grow faster, live, look, and feel better, even save lives. The sky is the limit for an influencer. So as I was reading the summary of this, what this book can do for me, so far I haven't realized a whole lot of change as a result of reading it, although I'm only halfway through. Maybe the good stuff will be at the end. Maybe. I cannot help but wonder, what would the inside cover of the Bible say? What would it say if it had an inside cover to try to market the Bible? For those potential buyers at Barnes & Nobles, for those surfing the net at Amazon.com, why would people choose the Bible? What would it say on that inside cover? Of course, we know there's no summary on the inside of our Bibles or the inside cover. But if there were, what might it say? Would it be similar to the inside cover of this particular book? If a potential buyer of the Bible were to open the pages and begin reading, would they find that the Bible has the ability to influence people to change? Maybe they would discover that the strategies that could be learned by the influential business leaders and behavioral scientists and the influencer could also be learned by the many different people discussed in the Bible. Maybe, just maybe, we could learn something about the influence and change from King David. Maybe it's Moses. Maybe it's Jesus Christ. Would the reader of the Bible find strategies for identifying behaviors that could lead to rapid and profound change? Could we read about a fascinating journey in which people in the Bible made improvements that would seem impossible to some? And finally, is it possible that by reading the lessons contained within the Bible, that we would learn how we could reach out and help others work smarter, grow faster, live, look, and feel better, and even save lives? I suspect that if the inside cover of the Bible were to have something similar to what's on the inside of this book, that it might read something like this. Now, this is my attempt to be somewhat creative. They tell me as an elementary principal, you have to be creative. I chose to teach high school for a reason, because I'm not creative. So here's my attempt to write the inside cover of the Bible with the help of Lori. Lori helped me a couple nights this week. So here's what I think it may say. Come join us as we take a fascinating journey through time. We will visit places such as the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve were influenced by the serpent to eat of the knowledge of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and forever change the course of human history. We will then travel to Canaan, where Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers. While in Egypt, Joseph was able to gain the trust of the Pharaoh, and in turn influence the fate of his family in many nations to come. Traveling to the Valley of Elah, the soon-to-be King David faces what appears to be an impossible task. He is to face Goliath, the Philistine. However, by placing his faith in God, young David not only faces the giant, but defeats him with a single stone hurled from his sling. Traveling to Jerusalem, we will read the story of Daniel. He was thrown into a lion's den, but because of his obedience to God, was not harmed. Jesus Christ, perhaps the most influential and fascinating person in the Bible, traveled far and wide. Jesus was noted to have made fishers of men. He caused blind men to see, lame men to walk, and deaf men to hear. However, possibly the most noteworthy acts of Jesus Christ were his raising of the dead and dying on the cross so that others may live. The Bible tells a story of hope, the story of change, and the story of life. It is through the stories in the Bible that God influences those that read it. Although the book Influencer speaks about behavioral scientists, talks about business leaders, a whole bunch of research in there, I would argue that the greatest influencer is God. So in the remaining time that I have here in this split sermon, I would like to show that God is the great influencer. The book The Influencer says that there are three things that influencers do, which I referred to right at the beginning of this sermon, but I'll repeat them. The influencer motivates us to change, motivates others to change. An influencer replaces bad behaviors with powerful new skills. And an influencer makes things happen. So the question is, how does God motivate others to change? The first skill. I know we can all think of many ways in which we ourselves are motivated to change. The book argues that in order, the book being The Influencer, orders that in order to change behaviors, you must first change minds. This involves new learning. In order to change minds, you have to involve new learning. Will Rogers, great philosopher, once said this about how people learn. There are three kinds of men. Three kinds of men. One that learns by reading. A few who learn by observation. And the rest of them have to pee on the electric fence and find out for themselves. I got the okay to put that joke in there. I questioned whether or not it was appropriate, but I asked some people and I got the clearance. So, the great philosopher Will Rogers, that's what he said about how people learn. There's many ways in which God teaches us. There's a Dr. Bandura, he's a behavioral psychologist. It's referenced several times within this book. But he said, one of the biggest ways that people learn is by watching others. I know that one of the biggest ways that I learn is by watching others. We're not able to see the actions of the people in the Bible. We're not able to see what they did, but we can read their stories. Another powerful way to learn. Through these stories that God has provided for us, He motivates us to change. We can be motivated to change by reading both positive and negative stories. God wants us to be obedient. But like children, we want to know what's in it for us at times. What's in it for us? Why do we want to be obedient? The Bible is full of examples of how obedience leads to blessings and how disobedience leads to trials. I want to start with a story of disobedience, which eventually turned into obedience. This is one of the boys' favorite Bible stories. We read it every night for months. I couldn't find the book. I was actually going to read it from the book, but it's somehow lost in the abyss of Jackson's closet. The story is the story of Jonah and the whale. As I read the story, we will become familiar with, and I want you to think to yourselves, which of the three men would Will Rogers, which of the three men that Will Rogers spoke about would describe Jonah? Did he learn by reading? Did he learn by observation? Or did he have to find out for himself? So if you turn to Jonah 1, I'm going to read through the story of Jonah, Jonah and the whale, beginning in verse 1 in Jonah chapter 1. I'll kind of skip through. I'm not going to read the entire story. We certainly know the story. It's nice to refresh our memories. So the title here is Jonah Flees from the Lord. It's kind of the subtitle that was on the top of my Bible as I look at Jonah 1. It said, "The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it, because its wickedness has come up before me." But Jonah ran away. He ran away from the Lord and headed to Tarshish. He went down to Joppa, where he found a ship bound for the port. After paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed, and he fled from the Lord. Then the Lord sent a great wind on the sea, and such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break up. All the other sailors were afraid, and each cried out for his own good. And they threw the cargo into the sea to lighten the ship. But Jonah had not gone below deck where he lay and fell into it. But Jonah did go below deck and laid where he fell asleep, a deep sleep. The captain went to him and said, "How can you sleep? Get up and call on your God. Maybe he will take notice of all of this that we may not perish." Then the sailors said to each other, "Come, let's draw lots. Let's find out who is responsible for this calamity." They cast a lot, and the lot fell on Jonah. So they asked him, "Tell us, who is responsible for making all this trouble for us? What kind of work do you do? Where do you come from? What is your country? From what people are you?" Verse 9, he answered, "I am a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." This terrified them, and they asked, "What have you done? What have you done?" They knew he was running away from the Lord because he already told them that. The sea was getting rougher and rougher, so they asked him, "What should we do to make the sea calm down?" Pick me up and throw me into the sea, he said, and it will become calm. I know that it is my fault that this great storm has come upon you. In verse 13, instead the men did their best to row back to land, but they could not, for the sea grew even wilder. And before, then they cried out to the Lord, please, Lord, do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man for you, Lord. Then they took Jonah and threw him overboard into the raging sea. At this, the men greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. And then we know it continues on into chapter 2. We know that the story ends with God sending the whale to eat Jonah. He remained in the belly for a while. Then the Lord commanded the whale to spit Jonah out to dry land. And then we know, after this trial, that Jonah obeyed the Lord. In chapter 3, in verse 1, it says, then the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time. He gave him a second chance. Jonah didn't obey the first time. He provided him a trial. He brought him out of the trial. And now he's given Jonah a second chance to do what the Lord asked him to do, what God asked him to do. He again said, go to the city of Nineveh and proclaim to it the message I give you. Jonah obeyed the word of the Lord and went to Nineveh. I'm sure you've decided, as I asked you, which one of the men was Jonah? I'm sure that you've decided he was not the man that learned by reading. He didn't learn by reading the Bible. He didn't learn by observation. He learned by doing what was wrong first, similar to the man that did not respect that electric fence. He disobeyed God and suffered the consequences. Before he chose to follow God's way and become obedient, he had to do it the wrong way first. Although God allows us to make mistakes, but he also expects that we learn from those mistakes. He provided us many stories in the Bible, Jonah and the whale being one of those, which gives us the opportunity to learn from others. We can't learn by seeing them. It happened long before us, but we can learn by reading. We can learn by reading the stories of what happened in the past. God doesn't only influence us through great storms and tossing us into the sea. He influences us through stories of hope and through stories of healing as well. Proverbs 3, verse 1. Turn to Proverbs 3, verse 1. He wants us again to be obedient to him. He influences us to be obedient to him in many different ways. In Proverbs 3, verses 1 through 2, it says, my son, do not forget my teaching, but keep my commands in your heart. For they will prolong your life many years and bring to you peace and prosperity. Here God tells us what happens if we're obedient. He does a similar thing in Psalm 119. You don't necessarily have to turn there. Psalm 19, verses 165 through 166. Here God says, great peace have those who love your law, and nothing can make them stumble. I wait for your salvation, Lord, and I follow your commands. Another Psalm, 121, verse 5. Psalm 121, verse 5. Said, the Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at night, or the Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over you coming and going, both now and forever. So we, in the Psalms and the Proverbs, God influences us to be obedient. He influences us to keep his commands, and by doing so, we will be given great blessings. The great blessing in this case is protection. He'll watch over us. He'll keep us safe. How does God replace bad behaviors with powerful new skills? How does he replace some of the negative behaviors that we have with new skills, which is the second trait in the Influencer book? The author of the book tells us that in order to change our behaviors, we have to identify certain vital behaviors. We have to identify vital behaviors. W. Edwards Deming, I have no idea who that is. He's in the book here. He says, it's not enough to do your best. It's not enough to do your best. You must know what to do and then do your best. Interesting thought. How many in this world do what they think is best? I would say quite a few. Most people do what they think is best. However, do they do what God thinks is best? Do they do what God expects from us? Kind of referenced Jimmy Buffett in the past. I enjoy listening to his music. Marilyn gave me a nice box set of his music. Been some time now. She found it when she was cleaning out. She didn't listen to it anymore, so she gave it to me. She's always wonderful for giving the boys gifts, and she's given Lori and I plenty of gifts. You know, we certainly miss her here in the Elmira area. But Jimmy Buffett, he has a song called My Job. My Job. The chorus goes something like this. I was going to sing it, but you don't want to listen to me sing. It says, it's my job to be better than the rest, and that's enough reason to go for me. It's my job to be better than the rest, and that makes the day for me. That's the chorus of the song. The whole premise of the song, he's talking about a street sweeper. A man comes up to the street sweeper and asks and wonders, how can this man be so happy doing such a menial job? He witnesses and watches him each day, and the guy's always whistling, having a grand time, sweeping the streets. And he wants to know, why? And the man simply replies that it's my job. I have to be better than the rest. And for him, that's what makes his day, trying to do the best he possibly can in the job that he's been given. There's a lesson in the song. God's blessed us all in different ways. We've all been blessed with different jobs. Whatever our jobs, whatever God has given to us, we should do our best. We should do our best at that and be thankful for what we have. In order to do our best, we must know what to do first. I'm still trying to figure that out as they plunked me into the elementary principal's job. Still trying to figure out what it is I'm supposed to do. Still a bit confused on some of the things. But we are blessed, brethren. We have been given the knowledge of God's laws. We know what to do. We know what to do. Many don't, but we do. We know what to do. However, many times we fall short. That is why God does not influence us only once in our lives. He didn't call us and then disappear. He called us, and he continues to have influence over each and every one of us. The Influencer book explains that we must identify the vital behaviors. God helps with that. Each year, God provides us an opportunity to identify vital behaviors. If I counted on the calendar correct, we're 12 weeks away from the Passover. It's kind of hard to believe. 12 weeks away. During the time leading up to the Passover, we all know that God instructs us to examine ourselves. During this process, we examine and we find vital behaviors. We look for behaviors that are sinful, but we can also look at the behaviors that are positive, that are in keeping with God's commands and God's laws. We can look at the behaviors. We can look at the behaviors that we have that are positive in keeping with his commands. And we can look at the behaviors that we do our best in. God's expectations of us is that we do our best. He's there to influence us. He's there to guide us and to help us along as we fall. The book explains that when trying to identify vital behaviors, it's beneficial to look to the best. Look to the best. So who do we look to? Who's the best? Who better to look to in the Bible than Jesus Christ when trying to identify vital behaviors that we can replace in our lives? God is not the only influencer in our lives. We certainly know that. He's not the only one who influences us. We know that Satan is a very effective influencer. We know that he uses temptation. He tries to throw us off course. Satan's a great marketer. I'm not sure what the inside cover of his book would say, but I would guarantee you that it would really tempt you to buy the book. He's a great influencer. The story in which the devil takes Jesus out to the desert and tempts him offers us power and safety. It gives us a lot of insight into the character of Satan, Jesus Christ's adversary. He makes vast promises, that's Satan, in exchange for worship, but simple scripture has the power to keep him at bay. Matthew 4. Matthew 4, we'll read the story about Jesus taken into the desert and being tempted by Satan, the great tempter. So Matthew chapter 4, verses 1, again, a very familiar scripture, but again, another example of how God helps to influence. Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Jesus answered, "It is written, 'Man shall not live by bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God.'" He tries again. Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down. For it is written, 'He will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up. They will lift you up in your hands, so that you will not strike foot against the stone.'" Well, again, Jesus answered him. He had an answer ready. "It's also written, 'Do not put the Lord your God to the test.'" He wasn't giving up. He's going to try again. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all of the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. "All this I will give you," he said, "if you bow down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, 'Worship the Lord your God and serve him only.'" The devil left him, and angels came and attended to him. So what's the lesson? We are all tempted all the time. We're all tempted all the time. Satan makes promises. As I said, he's a great marketer. He's a great influencer. We learn from Jesus Christ's example that by having the knowledge of the Bible and the understanding of God's word, we can change the behavior of trusting in ourselves, trusting in this world, and the promises of Satan. We learn to trust in God. We also learn that trusting God, we need to understand that he will never leave us. He will never tempt us beyond our abilities. A couple of scriptures speak to temptation. 1 Timothy 6, verses 9. 1 Timothy 6, verse 9 speaks to temptation. It says, "Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires." All of these desires, all of these temptations lead to destruction, as 1 Timothy tells us. 1 Corinthians gives a little different spin, but the message is the same. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, really no need to turn there. "No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it." God does allow us to identify some bad behaviors. He allows us to replace those bad behaviors with new skills. The skills we obviously learn from the stories and the people that he's given to us in the Bible. The Passover, the Days of Unleavened Bread, annual times throughout the year, where God provides us the opportunity to focus on the sin in our lives. He provides us with the tools, the skills through prayer, through fasting, and his word to resist the temptations and the influence of Satan the devil. The final characteristic that the book talks about, the final characteristic, the power of one. The power of one. Influencers make things happen. There's a section in the book that talks about the power of one. The premise of this section is that it only takes one person to influence an entire group of people. Stanley Milgram, he was a research scientist, I don't know, a long, long time ago. I hadn't looked at some of the tapes that he did for his research. They were all black and white, so they're quite some time back. It's not recent research. But he was a research scientist, and he was fascinated. I don't know if fascinated is the right word, but he really wanted to try to determine why one man could cause an entire army to annihilate a people. The one man he was interested in was Hitler. He wanted to know how one person, Hitler, could cause an army to follow him and take all the lives of that many human beings. So he set out to do some research. He conducted an experiment, and he framed it as teachers and learners. So he would have a teacher And the job of the teacher was to teach the learner pairs of words. He would give them a whole list of words, and then the learner's job was to repeat those words back with the correct pairing. That was the setup of the experiment. The learner was attached to electrodes, and the electrodes, bunch of wires were attached to a control panel. The experimenter, a guy in a white coat, was in there, and he was able to stand next to the teacher. The teacher was able to see the learner, but the learner was not able to see the experimenter or the teacher. It was a two-way glass. So they would communicate through microphones in that particular glass. So the experiment would start out where the teacher would give a list of words. The learner would have to repeat those back. And as you go through the experiment, there would be more and more words, which obviously makes it more and more difficult to repeat them back, not only with the correct pairing, but also in the correct order. Now, the experiment gets interesting is when the learner misses a pair, the teacher is told to give him an electric shock. So he would hit the button. The learner would receive an electric shock. He would scream and go through the whole thing there that would be involved with getting electric shock, which, by the way, happens to be the last obstacle in the Tough Mudder. You have to run through these wires that are apparently charged with high voltage, and of course you're all wet, you're tired, and you got to run through this whole gauntlet of electrical wires. Another fun thing to look forward to. I don't know why we're doing this. So in the experiment, the teacher and the learner, each time the learner would get a word wrong, he would get an electric shock. The second time he would get a word pair wrong, the shock would go up. And the control panel, it's kind of, there's some words on there, strong, very strong. And then at the end of it, very dangerous. And I can't remember the exact terminology on there, but it basically amounted to certain people could die if you hit this button. So what Milgram wanted to know is how far would the teacher go? Can one man cause extreme harm to almost to the point where he could kill another person? See, he didn't believe that Hitler had the power to do that. So he wanted, his actual goal in the experiment was to show that there was something else. It wasn't one man that could do it. See, the experimenter was the one man that was given the order. So every time that the learner got it wrong, he'd get a shock. Well, as you got up, the learner would scream a little bit more and more, obviously, because the shocks are more and more painful. When the teacher would say, "I'm done," the experimenter would simply say over and over, "The experiment requires that you go on." So he would say, read the list of words, the learner would do it, they'd miss it, he'd get an electric shock. The teacher would want to stop. The experimenter says, the experiment requires that you go on. And as you go through the experiment, you can see that, you know, many teachers, they went on all the way up to the point where it was dangerous, where it could kill them. Now, what the teacher didn't know was that the learner was an actor. There was no electric shocks being delivered. Nobody was being harmed. The person on the other side of the glass was an actor. And then they would do different variations of the experiment. Sometimes they were told that the man had a heart condition and that electric shock could kill him. And, of course, the actor would play that up as he was being electrocuted. You know, you're going to kill me. My heart hurts and this and that. And they would continue to go on. They would continue to go on. It was amazing the number of people that would inflict harm on fellow man because a guy in a white coat told him the experiment requires that you go on. Now, through the years, he did many different variations on this. And one of the things that he noticed as he did the variations is that when he allowed teachers to witness the teacher before them, that the previous teacher would have a whole lot of influence over the teacher to come next. So if the teacher that went before the new person continued down the board and gave all the electric shocks, typically the next teacher did the same thing. What was interesting was if a teacher stopped, typically the teacher after them also stopped. So what the experiment really shows is that one person does have a lot of power over us if we allow that to happen. The experiment showed that one man could change the behavior of others, whether it was the experimenter changing the behavior of what would be a normal person coming off the street. Now, they basically just put an ad in the paper and asked for people to do this teaching learning experiment. So they weren't handpicked. It was whoever volunteered. And, you know, they were typical normal people. And then they would do some interviews afterwards. And they would actually let the people know that, you know, during the course of the experiment, like the thing on the TV, no animals were harmed in this experiment type of thing. So they would let the people know that, you know, you really weren't shocking them. When they interviewed the people, they were amazed that they allowed a man in a white coat to inflict that much harm on another person. They couldn't believe it themselves that it was actually taking place. And again, the premise of the experiment was to show that we're influenced. If we allow it to happen, we are influenced. So the question becomes, do we allow God to be our influencer, or do we allow Satan to be our influencer? So if we were to follow one man, should it be Satan? Obviously a silly question, who I would equate in this case to the experimenter. Or do we follow Jesus Christ and God, who we would equate to the teacher that chooses to stop the experiment and stop the shocks? Mark 14. Almost wrapping up here. Mark 14. Verses 38. It says, "Watch and pray, so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." We see in Mark that it's easy to follow Satan. He is a great influencer. There's no doubt about it. He makes us do things sometimes that we wouldn't necessarily want to do. Like the teacher. We're not going to go out and shock people. Although the people in that experiment normally would not have done that. But they allowed themselves to be influenced by what they called the authority figure, which in that case was a man in the white coat. They allowed themselves to be influenced. When God called us, we were influenced. We were influenced to do things very, very differently. Well, some of us. I guess if you grew up in the church, maybe the difference wasn't huge. But those of us that, you know, were called in the church after living in the world for a time, a lot of differences. Although, even if you do grow up in the church, as you grow and learn and become older, more mature, there are some differences. God influences us to do things very, very differently. I know myself personally, I wasn't initially influenced by the brethren. I wasn't really influenced by the blessings from God, because I wasn't able to see that at the time. But what I was influenced by was what God was teaching. I know that as I went to church for the first, I don't know, year, maybe 2 years, I would listen to everything. You're influenced to read. You're influenced to learn. You hang on every word that the minister is speaking. Johnny Lambert was very good at helping bringing me in. He tailored some sermons that he knew I needed to hear, being somebody new. But you hung on every single word. You resisted a lot of what I used to do. I resisted that stuff. You knew that, you know, you heard resist the temptation of Satan, so you look for that stuff. And you hang on every word that you're hearing. I was truly, and I know many of us were truly influenced by the power of one at that time, that power being God. Through God the Father, Jesus Christ was able to provide us with many examples of influence. Matthew 17 is another great story of influence, another great story of influence. Matthew 4, verse 17 through 20, this is a story where Jesus Christ makes fishers of men, which I think was in my summary of what might be on the inside cover of the Bible. In verse 17, it says, "From that time, Jesus began to preach and say, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.' And Jesus, walking by the Sea of Galilee, saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and Andrew his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Then he said to them, 'Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men.' They immediately left their nets and followed him, going on from there. He saw two other brothers, James and John. They were in a boat with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets. He called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him." In verse 23, we go from calling fishers of men, so certainly Jesus Christ had great influence over these men. They dropped everything to follow Jesus Christ. What a great influence. Jesus heals a great multitude. Another example that we can look to. Jesus went about all Galilee. This is verse 23 in Matthew 4. "Teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease among the people. Then his fame went throughout all of Syria. And they brought to him all sick people who were afflicted with various diseases and torments, and those who were demon-possessed, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them. Great multitudes followed him." Again, great influence. Brethren, Jesus Christ, like God the Father, was a great influencer. God is able to influence people to make great changes in their lives. God influenced each of us to repent and to come to live His way of life. God utilizes the stories, the many stories, the many people that are contained within the Bible, and He uses those to continue to influence us. As the book The Influencer states, an influencer motivates others to change. An influencer replaces bad behaviors with powerful new skills. An influencer makes things happen. Brethren, God is our great influencer.